Good morning and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make the Elm City Ticket. A lot going on this week. Nothing ticks better than Pundit Friday, which we're about to begin here in the WNHH studio with the number one pundits in the media universe. Pundits like Babsarol's Ivy, the dairy-free goddess of our grassroots radio operation, the belle of our ball, and the managing editor of the Inner City News, and she's the host every morning here on WNHH of Love Babs.
I am.
Love Talk. Like the flyest news hunter-gatherer this side of Fleet Street, boss of the Budget Beat and Beauty Beat.
I still like it.
Star New Haven independent reporter Markeisha Ricks.
Happy Friday, people.
Markeisha!
Is this thing on?
The queen of quippery, the quintessence of compassion, La Voz Hispana publisher Norma Rodriguez Reyes. The bravest man in New Haven, WNHA station manager and unrepentant Donald Trump supporter. This week more than ever, actually.
Oh, my God.
Harry Dros. Yes,
Lord,
you got your taste of that, Joe. And then we have the righteous reaper of restitution,
Mr.
Top 2, drop 2 percenter, the exalted expostulator of extemporous exegesis, bossa nova, mover and shaker, the griot of the grassy knoll, the conquistador of cussing criminals, keeper of the cure, weaver of wellness and wisdom, mellifluous and meritocratic, miner of melody, the plow driver of peace. He's the driver out of demons, discord, and dissonance, the optimizer of opulence and opportunity, the undertaker of unfiltered utterance, the erudite earl of ergonomics, the liberated lion of lucidity, the maniacal monarch of mercy, the blistering barbecuer of brain-dead bozos, our executioner of existential enemies, the alchemist of assonance and alliteration, zealous zapper of xenophobia, sagacious sergeant salt and swing, prize protected against pusillanimity, the distinguished duke of diplomacy and detente, king of conspiracy concoction, deacon of the dozens, bodhisattva of battle rap, missionary of modesty, mesmerizer of the masses, shaman of the shoreline, potentate of 360 state, the recognized ringleader of risque repartee, the eighth wonder of the world, wizard of wise guy waggery, the capo of casual conversation, first name in flame, daring don of don't do liberation, sultan of spit west Indian, whisperer of wonk, emperor of explosive exposition, the esteemed elucidator of ebonics, top tier talent from Trinidad and Tobago, daft tone deliverer of decency, maximal media maestro, bodacious boldface barista bop, chess master chill, primo practitioner of prop prestidigitation, beyond just somewhat honorable high priest of hip hop, right reverend of rapture, reigning raconteur of riffitude, sanctified slayer, the slow witter, witted, the never late for supper, decorated, dazzling, indefatigable, dumplings, right, and dinner dishes, maximum exologist, Joe Ugly of the Joe Ugly Show in the morning.
Finally.
Welcome. We all
are
impressed.
I started reading an article.
Hey.
Welcome, everybody. Now, he's got a lot of
doing
names.
My Christmas card.
But was that Joe Ugly we saw coming out of the White House putting his thumbs up yesterday?
Oh, Lord.
Was that Babsarol's Ivy or Norma? Was that
Harry Dros? That was a guy called another Joe.
What different Joe from
New
Haven?
That's another Joe from New Haven.
Joe Lieberman. That was the guy. Sir. In other words, a guy who's never done a criminal trial. Uh-huh. A guy who's never worked at a law enforcement agency.
Mm-hmm.
A guy who's just been elected to political office is in running, the leading contender.
That's right.
To be the FBI chief.
It's called hush money.
Joe Lieberman, the former senator here from Connecticut, charmed Donald Trump. And Donald Trump said he liked him the best. And it's clear from the coverage this morning that Donald Trump's staff freaked out and said, after all this controversy, you fired your FBI chief last week. The country's in an uproar. There's a special investigation. The FBI is in tatters. And you're going to name a politician with no experience who every Democrat now is wants to burn down Washington if you name him,
right.
who's never done it. He's done only civil law as a former attorney general in Connecticut. You're going to name him the head of the FBI? But Donald Trump liked him, so it'll be a war now between Donald Trump and all his aides about whether he goes through with it. What do you guys think?
I think he's doing it because he's looking to get McCain on his side for this.
Right, John McCain is best buddy of Joe Lieberman. John McCain has been a thorn in the side of Donald Trump. John McCain is very excited that his buddy Joe Lieberman, who, by
the way,
more
than just John McCain, it's also Lindsey Graham.
That's right, they were a trio.
Yeah,
they were.
You know, I'm just tired of this administration and their overzealousness in deliberately choosing people who are not qualified to do any.
Well, let's see what Harry Dros thinks. Harry Dros used to say that you should appoint qualified people to positions, but he loves Joe Lieberman. He loves Donald Trump. What do you think?
I like Joe Lieberman.
I really like Joe Lieberman. He's a Democrat, right?
No.
He used to be a Democrat. And then they booted him pretty much. So he ran as an independent to win his last term as senator.
Pretty much. They did.
Karl Rove.
They booted him out.
And George W. Bush thought it was so important to reelect Joe Lieberman that they supported him over the Republican candidates and independent get reelected. So to say he's a Democrat is changing history.
True.
He is a Democrat, and Connecticut booted him out, but not the Democrats. He actually caucused with the Democrats in on the Senate side.
Because that so was that the
he
numbers.
Could, so that he could negotiate to preserve a Senate chairmanship.
That's right.
After the Democrats were still in charge of that body.
That's all. It was a numbers game, man.
It was a numbers game. Yeah. And he put him over the top. Yeah, so that means if he caucused with the Democrats, he's a Democrat. Just like Bernie Sanders.
But wait a second. No. He also undercut everything Democrats tried to do.
Correct.
He's the reason they didn't get Medicare down to 55 years old. He worked with Republicans on that. He's the reason he used to unite with Jesse Helms on positions like anti-gay legislation, no money for suicidal teens. He's embraced by all the Republicans, and since he got out of office, who was he up at the Capitol with this session?
Betsy DeVos
trying to get him. All his alliances now, all his positions are completely Republican.
And I'm surprised that people don't use the word sellout.
To be a stormtrooper just marching.
I don't understand why they don't ever use the word sellout for him. Like, why don't they ever use that word?
That's a good point, you know, but Lieberman, well,
listen, if I go to that.
But anyway, Harry Styles has said, forget about liking Joe. I like Joe personally. Joe's a nice guy. I hate everything he did in politics for the last 3 years. But Harry, actually, I never voted for Joe, even when he was a Democrat.
No?
I always thought he was a phony. But anyway, I like him a lot personally, but I thought he always went to where the money was and the power and sucked up to it. As soon as he got to Washington, he went right with William F. Buckley and the anti-caste circuit and all this stuff. But Harry, do you think he's qualified to run the FBI when he's never had any experience in this field at all?
Okay, I can't qualify Joe, but not even Joe Ugly. But, you know,
not to run the FBI.
I guess, you know, it's a political appointment. And we know Comey, who was overqualified, didn't do a good job either.
But wait a second. Whether James Comey did a good job, are you making the point that therefore someone who's a career officer in the FBI shouldn't be picked because someone who was no good? It is not a political appointment, Harry. I would take issue with that. They've never named anyone to run the FBI with the lack of experience that Joe Lieberman has. Do you think that's a good idea?
I like it.
So when you need to have some surgery, you should call me.
Comey.
You like me well enough.
Comey did a horrible job, and he was
so true. Therefore, so here's wait. I want to get this, because I love the Trump apologists this week. The new arguments they've come up for stuff just dazzle me. So if James Comey does a bad job as FBI director, therefore we should pick someone who has no experience and is just a politician to run the nation's law enforcement apparatus.
It wasn't how we elected our president?
I don't know if he has no experience. He was on the Intelligence Committee. He was on the Senate. He was very involved with the intelligence community when he was a senator. So let's not say he's not completely unqualified.
But the thing about it is Joe Lieberman do not have the executive experience to run the FBI.
He didn't run the Attorney General's office here, which is a big law firm.
But that's not the same as running the FBI.
And you have usually an Attorney General's office, it's the other folks in the office that are bringing the cases, right?
Right. Running the
FBI. Manage it,
running the Federal Bureau
of Investigations.
Running the FBI is really, actually, I think they should go within, to be quite honest. I think they should look
they
for
should
someone.
They should keep the guy that's acting right now.
The acting, you know.
That'll be interesting because Trump claimed he was considering that guy, but he testified against Trump and said his version of events weren't true. What do you think, Norma? You followed Joe Lieberman a long time. Would he make a good FBI director?
To me, he was elected Vice President of the United States. He's from Connecticut. And
talking about the 2000 election.
When he was really elected. If it had not been for the electoral vote, he would have been the Vice President of the United States. So if this country elected him to be Vice President of the United States, you know, sometimes when we use the word he's a politician, I mean, I really believe there's a lot of good politicians out there that really function from their heart and from their brains.
What about the fact that he's been doing work for Donald Trump's law firm since he's been out? And the issue this week was whether Donald Trump did or didn't involve himself in obstructed investigation to his administration. Oh, Joe, you got to read the New Haven Independent. We had a story earlier this week about how Joe Lieberman has been a senior counsel at the law firm that's been doing all Trump's law firms, including trying to shut up the New York Times.
And not yesterday, like for a good while.
So anyway, given that part of the controversy this week is that there's a perception, right or wrong, that Donald Trump interfered with investigation, right or wrong, that's why he fired Comey, and you can argue that both ways. Why would you bring in somebody who is from his personal law firm to then run the FBI?
No, you're absolutely right. You know, now, this is something that I I was not. Look, they had so much breaking news this week. I can't keep up on all of it.
But, you know, I talked to lawyers here about whether that should disqualify Joe.
It should.
So David Rosen said, slam dunk. He teaches at Yale and this kind of stuff. He said, you cannot be from the law firm that represents the president and come in to run the agency investigating the president's administration at a time when questions have been raised. Right. Other people say Norm Pattis, who's an attorney who voted for Trump, he said he thinks there are a lot of reasons you can't pick Joe, one of which is he's 75, it's a 10-year term, he has zero experience in criminal law, how can you then run the FBI? But he thought it doesn't disqualify you. There are 270 lawyers at that firm. He said very often one person in a firm doesn't know what the other one is doing. So while he thought it was a horrible idea to pick Lieberman, he didn't think that it was a conflict of interest. The Democrats have all abandoned Joe for a lot of reasons, but that is one of the reasons they're doing it. They say if we're going to restore public confidence, even Donald Trump himself said, even though he thinks he's been unfairly treated, that this week's events has divided the country and that you have to win that
this week's events?
Yeah, right. And so
the argument here is that how are you going to regain confidence in the integrity of the FBI and the independence if you're picking one of Trump's lawyers there? Any concerns for you, Harry Joseph, defender of Donald Trump?
No concerns at all. What you guys are saying is that Donald should pick somebody who hates him, and then you guys would feel better. Come on.
No, what we are saying
is that you're not. That's what you're saying.
No, you want Rachel Maddow.
Rachel Maddow won our poll. We said who should be picked for FBI director, and in fact, she got the most votes over Glenn Beck.
Who?
Wow.
Rachel Maddow instead of Maddow. It's not nice. You hear that? You're talking about, you have Joe Ugly on your panel. Joe, who makes fun of everybody from 6 to 9 a.m. in the morning.
Hey. Wait a second. You're talking about the way someone 11. Looks. To call someone a cow because you don't agree with her opinions is low.
There you go. You guys always, this is a natural thing for Democrats.
Harry, you take
everything out of context. I didn't call
it.
Her a cow. I said mad cow. You know what mad cow disease is? See? When you guys always go down the wrong path.
Here, answer the question.
Mad cow disease. Anyway, Rachel Maddow.
You going to let me answer this? You going to let me answer your question?
No, I didn't ask the question.
But let me tell you about Rachel Maddow.
The question that you did ask
No, tell us about why you're perfectly fine with Joe Lieberman.
Oh, I'm fine with Joe Lieberman. I think he's a great guy.
The question you asked was, are we going to allow, should Trump choose someone that's going to go against them to run the FBI? That was your question that you
I'm
asked.
I'm giving Joe the space to finish his thought. Go ahead, Joe.
That was your question.
And you said
that's what I wanted. Well, here's what I was saying.
I think I'm skipping my race to be there.
Here's what I'm going to say. Here's what
You're
I was saying about
You're listening to WNHH
that.
Radio.
Broadcast on 103.5 FM. You're home for community radio and broadcast at newhavenindependent.org.
Move on.
Joe, you got one last chance here. What were you going to say?
I don't even think I got a chance.
All right, but let me ask you about something else. This week, another big news, one of Joe Lieberman's friends, actually, Rabbi Daniel Greer.
Joe Lieberman. Let's go, okay.
Rabbi Daniel Greer in New Haven has been a big force in New Haven for decades. He came here to go to Yale Law School, became a big shot in New York, deputy mayor to John Lindsay. He came here, built a whole new community in the Edgewood neighborhood. It was run down, all these beautiful old houses. He started Yeshiva Orthodox School and the old Roger Sherman School. He became a political force in that neighborhood. He also fixed up dozens and dozens of houses and rented them out and started a yeshiva there. But over the years, he was apparently allegedly raping the boys. And one of them finally sued him. And this week, Christopher Peake wrote a bunch of stories up in federal court. A federal jury awarded $20 million, including $5 million in legal fees.
Man.
And it was deep because this is a community in New Haven. It wasn't my synagogue, but I did used to go and pray there, and I knew the people. It tore apart this community that developed there. And he's very politically influential, Daniel Greer. And the New Haven police never really, even when these allegations came out, never did much in an investigation. They said statute of limitations up, even though it's still a school with kids there. But it tore apart this community that loved having this walkable Jewish community there and all these beautiful old homes, even though they had big fences you couldn't see through. And it sent shockwaves. And it turns out that a second person who came forward was one of the prime movers of that school. His parents founded the school in the community with Greer. They worshipped him as a leader. Turns out he was allegedly, according to testimony, for many years sexually abusing this guy too, and then made him assistant principal of the school, who was aware of the other abuse and never reported it. So it went pretty deep. Any thoughts about the verdict?
Where's the verdict? Where's the... How? Woo! Where's the school? The situation now with the school? Is it still in existence? Well,
everyone pulled out of the school, and he found some kids, or I guess troubled kids from another state, and they're now at their, the school's in existence.
From another state?
Well, they always came. And apparently a lot of abuse took place in these buildings. They have the, he has all these not-for-profits he set up that renovate the buildings and run them and rent them out, and the kids dorm in those buildings.
I think what's always really wild to me about like a civil case, because it's not a criminal case, he's not, even though effectively the court has said he's not going to jail, he's not going to be on a sex offender list or any of these things, and yet he still runs a school
with kids.
There are kids there, and it's up to these parents to pay attention to this and decide whether or not to keep their kids in the school. Like, that's crazy.
That is totally
crazy. And when this broke, everyone here put their kids out, and they no longer have the elementary school.
But how did these like other parents not know? Like, I just
And it's funny, you know. I think he did a lot of good as well, like in fixing up those problems.
But a lot of people Bill Cosby did a lot of good things. But
serial killers, murderers, rapists, child exploiters, pimps—they all do a lot of good. Nobody is inherently evil.
I was thinking too. Like, he also was a force. He was a fan of Sarah Palin. He was a force. He had some run-ins with black community. He testified and lobbied statewide against gay marriage. He you know, called homosexuality immoral. So he was one of those guys too.
One of those self-haters.
I
don't never know where to go with these stories. It's like, it just hits you.
I felt so bad for that community. I actually loved praying there, even though it went against a lot of my even religious values, because the synagogue I belonged to was egalitarian women. My kids grew up, daughters, you know, leading services, reading from the Torah. My wife was president of the congregation. At his place, you know, no women. It's all only the men do the stuff. And I knew what their politics were. But yet there was an intensity with the way they prayed and a concern for their neighborhood that I found kind of inspiring. And his kids are kids have all left town. I mean, he doesn't speak to his kids anymore. They don't speak to him. But they did a lot of care in the community, keeping up cemeteries, organizing to keep their neighborhood clean for everybody, you know, and keeping crime out. It was kind of, I agree with Babs, right, of people who do, and he does, do horrible, horrible things. They're often complicated. I think part of the psychology is people who believe there are no limits. It's like we had a great police chief a couple of decades ago, and I know the man, I like him. He believed there were no limits in how you could do policing and that the old rules don't have to apply. Cops don't have to always arrest people. You could have them getting to know the community, even the people who do bad things, and help them get rehabilitated rather than locked up. And he did a lot of good, but he also believed there are no personal limits in his own personal life. I think they often go hand in hand. And remember, he fathered a kid with a prostitute, didn't first acknowledge him, and then DCF came after him, and then he brought up the kid. I mean, I think Greer was a person who also didn't believe in limits, and maybe that enables you to do interesting things on policy or for community, but also makes you feel like you can violate people's, I don't know, what do you think, Norman?
Go ahead.
Yeah. He is accountable, no question.
You know, the sad part about all this is that...
Norman, can you get close to the mic?
Is that this is not, many times, it's not an exception, okay? In Penn State, he was doing exactly the same thing Rabbi Greer was doing.
And what we're hearing now is the private schools and the religious schools. So we're hearing about Choate just came out something, right. The school in
so
Kent.
All this has been going Priests. On, is going on. And the problem is that there's people that look the other way. For many times, institutions feel this is stuff that you take and you sweep under the rug, you send them someplace else, and it still continues. And many people believe you keep these things in the closet. You don't talk about it because you're ruining somebody's life forever. Right. But the truth is that this happens all the time. When does it stop? How does it stop?
My concern my concern stands is this individual is still allowed to have a school and have kids in it.
Right, and my question is, how do you then physically stop it? So like DCF, Department of Children and Families at the state.
How is there a statute of limitations on that?
Well, the school, they were called in a few years ago to say there's problems at the school with how he's dealing with kids. So they went, they didn't see anything, and nobody told him anything. So how do you? So if everyone feels like, of course, how could this go on? Why aren't the police do something? DCF, what can they legally do? As Babs pointed out, or Markeisha, this was a civil proceeding. So it's not, he hasn't been criminally found guilty of committing any crimes. How do you think as a former police commissioner, Babs, how do you think the system can prevent this from going on if there aren't any criminal accusations, any kind of basis to act on?
You mean like harming children?
How do you stop it?
I don't know if you can stop it. I think you really what you have to do is just raise awareness. You have to empower people to say what they see when they see it.
So that it doesn't done to them. I mean, so know, many of the people who are abused don't feel
they don't fit. They
capable
don't. They,
of,
they
of,
don't tell it. Yeah. And we've created this environment where if you do tell, everything about you becomes.
Oh,
fodder.
And they were vicious about this guy on the stand this week. I mean, if you read Christopher Peake's articles, the lawyer was accusing this guy of everything in the sun, and even contesting the whole idea of PTSD and belittling that, and. You know,
and calling him a liar and a cheat.
Yeah, calling a liar and
but
cheat.
That's what I mean, but that's what, you know, when
it
I used
to rape victims.
When I used to run rape crises, right? When I used to work at Rape Crisis when it was at the Y. And you know, we do all this work and we go to courts with women and sometimes men who were assaulted. And you know, it's stunning how everything about the person who is saying this happened to them, everything about their lives becomes the reason why they were harmed. Everything. From what they wore to where they were to who they know to what they do becomes the reason or part of the reason why you brought this on yourself.
Yeah, because as part of Chris's article, didn't it mention that like what was brought out was that Rabbi Greer was invited to this man's wedding.
Right.
And the even that is used against you.
Oh, it was. And one of his other accusers, the guy who he had the best friend's son, who was also best friend of his own son, and who he'd been sex abusing allegedly for many years and then became assistant principal. He talked about how they worshiped him as like a god and he would make them feel special that he was having sex with them. And he would say, like, this other kid I'm having sex with, he's more handsome than you are, but you're the one who has the brilliant mind. And it becomes all caught up. I mean, it's really an abuse by the adult of the power you have over the person and the legitimacy you have with that person.
And that, I feel like, is very key, the abuse of power. In the case that you named, in the Penn State case, that's somebody who, you know, is supposed to be a trusted adult in these young people's lives. And they're abusing that position they're using that position in a predatory way.
And then the wife knowing all about it.
And I can tell you, if these kids, young people, probably did say something to someone and someone said to them, oh, no, you must be mistaken, or you can't say that, or don't say that, or... oh, no, you know, you imagine that, or, you know, you can't say that about the rabbi, preacher, teacher, whatever. You know, you're shut down, right?
And it's interesting because when he lavishes attention on you, but also allegedly taking to motels and showing you pornography when you're a kid and giving you
alcohol. This is wrong, but at the end of the day, this is somebody that you've been taught to trust and respect. So if he says it's okay, even if it feels wrong to you, I always remember my mother telling me, if somebody makes you uncomfortable, get away from that person. I don't care who it is, in our family, anybody.
And they also pick on vulnerable people. Run. Like, I went to a high school called Horace Mann in New York. And after, I knew at the time I'd heard that there were boys who were being raped by the teachers or having sexual relationships with. It was
not
kinda,
sexual relationships. Rape is the right word.
Yeah. And 20 years later or 30 years later, it all came out. And it came out about the years I was there, about people I knew, rooms I was in, remembering the people with them. And I remember at the time, there's one guy, they wrote one story about this one teacher who had a cult following. And I remember they never kind of messed with kids like me, who like, they were kind of scared of, that, you know, because I'd write articles in the paper, we had underground newspaper, that kind of stuff. They thought we'd give them the finger.
Paul Beasy exposing people.
No, but I remember, but I didn't expose anyone then. I'm thinking back to the kids they went with, and it really was the kids who were lost. They didn't have, one, I remember their father had just died, and they became an acolyte of this guy. And I'm thinking here with the Greer case too, which is that it's often the kids who are going to be the least likely to rat you out because they feel weak to begin with, and the predatory teachers.
But that's really wild considering, like, I wouldn't say so much that they were weak because, oh, they're, like, isolated in certain ways. They're weak because of their connection, his father being a founder and him not wanting to hurt his own father by ratting out.
Yeah, there's so much at stake of that whole community would have grown.
Exactly.
But not the one who brought the lawsuit. He was from out of town.
Okay.
And I remember in the school I went to, I think there's a radar that the predators have of a weakness when they sexually abuse people. I think that people who are needy in some way.
I don't know if it's a weakness. I think it might be a sense of vulnerability.
Vulnerability.
You know, because, I mean, I see it all the time. Well, I used to sit, I don't do this work anymore, but I used to sit all the time with the folks who would get raped and things would happen. And I think predatory people know how to pick out.
Yeah.
Single out.
And we're in a little bit dangerous territory talking with all rape because there are cases of stranger rape.
Yes.
There's relationships, you know, marriages. I'm thinking specifically in a school setting with impressionable young people who need an authority figure. So I'm thinking this one guy whose father had died and he became a, quote, Burmanite with this teacher Berman who had the cult. And I even used to write things about this crazy cult wise when looking up this guy. But he then started becoming an acolyte of this guy. And then I'm reading in the New Yorker decades later about how this teacher who made himself out to be the Shakespearean scholar was making them take off their clothes and have anal sex with them and stuff. You know, it was kind of crass. But I remember that I think it was, so again, I'm thinking of one subset of the kind of predatory behavior that maybe it is identifying that vulnerability when there's a lack of an authority figure of a young person.
But even if you have an authority figure, what happens is, I can tell you kids probably have told, or they've exhibited behaviors so that, you know, if the awareness was there, you would say, okay, something is happening to this child. You know, why is this child wetting the bed? Why is this child refusing to want to go do the things that they like to do? Why is this child isolated? Why is this child, you know, have changed friends completely? Why is this child dressing in black clothes all the time? Or yeah, whatever it is, whatever the change is, you know, the awareness has to be, adults have to notice when things happen to kids and their behavior shifts so that somebody could go to that kid and say, what is happening? What has happened? Talk to me. Share with me what's going on. I'm here for you.
And how do those know? So a lot of us who had been in the building where Rabbi Greer operated, and I was in there more times than I can remember, we're all scratching our heads. I was speaking to one of them this morning. When you look back at events afterwards and say, gee, we should have known. So there's a blogger named Larry Noodles who's been used to blog in The Independent when he was in prison. He used to be part of that community. And he feels like he should have done something because his Kent, they were for a year. Kid went there for a year and heard that there was like some guy who was like biting the ear of one of the kids who was put in solitary. He says he kind of feels like he should have rescued them. And he attacked me saying, because I wrote exposés about the real estate dealings of that organization in the 90s when I was at the New Haven Advocate and now defunct Alt Weekly. And I said it was kind of like a cult. So he said, well, why didn't you go further and find out there was sex abuse? Or even more recently, I remember there's someone who's still loyal to Rabbi Greer. We were at prayers there. And I saw a teenage boy freak out one day when Rabbi Greer was correcting him sternly about how he pronounced Hebrew at this prayer session. This was like a year, 2 years ago, something. And he started having this fit and striking out at the rabbi. And in the car, we were trying to figure out what happened. So when you look back at that and said, but it's tricky with, and we're saying something weird happened in that room. But you know, Bab said, you know, it's so important for when adults see something wrong to step in to protect them. But it is kind of hard to know at the time to make the leap from, therefore, there's something not kosher, therefore, it's sexual. I think when a lot of people in New Haven look back at their interaction with Greer's organization, they might feel guilt. They might have said, why didn't someone blow the whistle on this sooner? Because he was such a martinet. He was such a authoritarian figure who would have rage if people questioned him. But it's kind of hard at the time to connect dots and say there's something sexual going on.
No, it's not. That's just people trying to ease their conscience about their inability to ask the question. We're not asking people to run in there with capes on. We're asking people to sort of ask the question. What is something happening to you? What is, and noticing and paying attention to.
So should I have said to that boy, should I have met him on another occasion and said, are you getting raped?
No, what she just said was
I'm not being sarcastic at all. I'm really wrestling with this question.
Any kind of abuse.
And I think Babs has a great point. That's why I'm asking this question.
I even like the your approach is anything happening to you? Those are very interesting words. Those are great choice of words.
That could go anywhere.
It's actually saying you're not accusing, if you're not making a kid feel uncomfortable, if they may feel like if they don't want to talk about rape or abuse in that level, but you say anything happening to you. And you, from that, you could build off of that, because a question like that is so open-end. You know, you could, how do you go home? Or how do you get
and
home?
And I'm wrestling so this because Bab said it. I don't mean to discount the question. So I watch this kid and I say, well, gee, it looks like a teenager who's upset about having a difficult time. You know, when you're growing up, it's difficult. You don't like that this authority figure is correcting you in front of other people about how you pronounce Hebrew. You're throwing a fit about it. I threw fits as a teenager and no one was abusing me. So in what circumstances do you draw a line, and in what circumstances do you say weird stuff always happens at schools and with teenagers?
You know, something people also often say too is because the person have good reputation, they tend to think, oh, you know, it's all safe for this person. Oh, they did a good thing, you know, so he must be just disciplining them that way.
Well,
you know,
I don't know. From my personal experience, I was raised Catholic. And we had this priest, Father Strauss, who used to always hang out in the rectory. And he used to bring all the kids, come sit on my lap and all that. And I remember him rubbing my back. I never sat on his lap because he rubbed my back. And he's like, come here, let me talk to you. And I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. and I told him, don't touch me. And then on another occasion, I saw him, you know, sit my sister on his lap, who was 3 years younger than me. And I went over there and I grabbed her and I told him, stay away from my sister. And my friends and I would, because we used to hang out at the rectory to catch, you know, get girls. And we used to always spread the word, perv, he's a perv, he's a perv, he's a perv. But still, you would see the kids go and sit on his lap, even young teenage girls go sit on his lap. And you could tell the guy was a creep. You know, so I don't know what it is that, you know, even if some people are telling you, guy's a perv, they will still do it. You can't control.
I think that sort of goes back to what Babs was saying, is that, you know, there are kids who do tell. There are people who say something, and people will say, you're mistaken. That can't possibly be what's happening.
How old were you, Harry?
I was about, I'm going to say 12, 13, and my sister was about 9 when that happened. But
so, Babs, because I'm so interested in what you said earlier, Babs. So how could society have reacted in that situation? So Harry was 12 or 13. He was calling out this guy as a perv with people his own age. What could happen next to have prevented that priest?
I think the next thing should have happened is that these kids could have felt confident enough or empowered enough to go talk to another adult and say, you know, this is what has happened. Or, you know, like in my church now, we have a safe church policy that no child can be in the company of an adult by themselves. So,
but look at this, Babs. Look, for example, Penn State, as you raised Norma. These were young adults.
Yeah.
And they still felt uncomfortable going and telling someone else because
because there's so much pressure on you to succeed and not let people down, that I think that is the defining factor for allowing that kind of abuse to happen. And nobody wants to be singled out, right? Nobody wants to be the one to sort of make the house of cards come down, right? So you just sort of just be quiet. There were adults in that organization that knew what was happening just was like,
or in a situation where somebody's put in a position of authority even after they've been abused. So then what?
Yeah.
That's just like strategically and wickedly, like predatorily smart. Like
that priest stood there and he died there, you know. But there was this Sister Mary Lawrence, I remember her, because she was the type that would come in and you could say anything to her. And we did, you know, talk about our concerns with him. Always, he was touchy. He was touchy-feely, always grabbing. And my wife, to this day, remembers him because she remembers him grabbing her. And she just used to tell us, stay away from him. But she never did anything about it. But she was like the sweetest person in the world. But I think about it now, she let the kids down. I don't know if he ever molested. I can't say he molested anyone. But he was a creep. He was touchy-feely, and he shouldn't
And people do let kids down. I mean, adults let kids down every day.
So what do we do with kids needing hugs and touching? It's kind of tricky. So do you remember Hill Cooperative Youth Services in Troy Square, the youth center? Remember that, Norma? There's a guy, Bummy Moore, there for decades.
Bummy.
No one's ever suggested Bummy anything wrong. And the thing that struck me when I was there, this was years back, was how every kid wanted to come up to either get a hug or a high five from Bummy. I felt like every kid just wanted to touch Bummy. He didn't go out and touch them. But they all wanted to have some contact and recognition of hi to Bummy. And it was great. And you do have, you know, you do have adults who end up having this responsibility when you're with kids, especially their turning points in their lives, when you do talk to them alone and give them great advice. I've had great mentors. So how do we balance the need for contact between adults and kids and this horrible problem about unchecked predation?
I mean, you have a sense of, I mean, the people who are predatory and who are going to harm children, they have a whole different kind of agenda. And usually those are the people that get whispered about. And people know that. We know who the predators are.
12-year-old Harry and his friends knew.
You know, right. And so the word is out, don't. But then at the same time, there are people who can be in the presence of children and uplift them and be about raising them and being good to them, right? So there is a real
kids
difference.
Kids need hugs.
Well, yeah.
I don't know, well, Norman Rodriguez Reyes, when you grew up in a religious community in the Hill, how comfortable were people to raise questions about authority figures in a religious community, in your opinion?
When we were growing up, you know, those kind of things you never talked about. You kept in the closet and you just looked the other way. And it wasn't until this whole campaign that, you know, that you got to tell that the younger generation started. But, you know, I came from a background where there was a lot of incest. Because now we're not talking about strangers.
Right.
You know, we're talking about fathers and uncles and, you know, that kind of stuff. And the sick part about it is that it's still happening today.
Yeah, I think most of the statistics say that it's somebody you know.
It definitely is. And then also, you know, the whole thing that we were taught, don't let anyone know that you're damaged goods.
Mm. Oh.
You know, that was the part that you grew up with. Those are things you keep in the closet. You don't tell anyone about because nobody wants to buy damaged goods.
Oh, my. Wow.
Wow.
That's deep.
Whoa.
And you are listening to Pundit Friday on Dateline New Haven on WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. This is not our usual jolly, high energy, yeah, make light of everything day on Pundit Friday. But it was a week in which some budget reality hit New Haven. So until this week, we're moving along to approve a new city budget of $545 million general operating budget. And it had an assumption in it that we were going to get $31 million in added municipal aid from the state this year. And that was a promise that came from the governor and top legislators. So it was a reasonable assumption. But then the bottom fell out of the state budget. We now have a $5 billion projected deficit for 2 years. We're getting cut money that we already had approved for us this year. We have a spending freeze that Mayor Harp declared this week for the last 6 weeks of this fiscal year because the state just pulled out $1.9 million that we were getting, as well as $1.3 million extra for the Board of Ed. So, Markeisha, you went to a meeting this week at which the Board of Alders Finance Committee did the second to last act of this long process of approving a budget. They voted one, but they cut $13 million out, and they said they're probably going to cut more at the end. What was the mood like, and what is this going to mean for how the city operates?
So, the $13 million cut actually is the mayor's revised budget. So, you know, I don't want to say that the Alders cut it out. The mayor cut it out. And they accepted those cuts, and they kind of expressed that they were happy that they felt like they were getting a more realistic picture, because they were a little low key upset with her budget projections relying on that added $31 million when even though the words that were coming out of people's mouths like, oh, we'll be able to get there, the reality was every day it looked like the state was hemorrhaging.
And the governor himself put out a new proposed budget.
Exactly,
cut
exactly. So, but Alders still think that there's going to have to be more cuts the way this thing is shaking out.
Two things struck me about your article this week and people's conversations. So even though they're cutting aid, they're going to cut aid to all these cities, they're actually going to increase it $50 million to Hartford. Mm. And the reason is that
to
Hartford might
bankruptcy?
Be declaring bankruptcy. Mm. And as one former mayor said to me, well, gee, they'll give them all that money this year, but that doesn't stop them from meeting it the next year.
Right.
But New Haven sort of gets penalized in one sense because our fiscal house has sort of been in order. We haven't had a deficit for years while Bridgeport had $30 million deficit. Hartford's looking at bankruptcy. So one thing that struck me is that even though these are very tough fiscal times, we're in fact not in crisis. And the second thing that struck me about that is that when you looked at these $13 million in cuts, that I went over them with someone who's a real critic of the Harp administration. And he said these were actually good cuts. They weren't cheap. Like, yes, there's some refinancing of debt, but it's not for the most part to put off paying it later. It's actually that interest rates got cheaper. Or they found a way to pay contracts up front with some short-term borrowed money where you'd pay less for the interest on that short-term borrowing than you actually save from paying it all in one piece. They're finding ways cut around the corner that actually don't cut the bone because we're in better fiscal shape. Now, it's still going to hurt. There's no question. At some point, they're going to have to be layoffs because I don't think they're going to raise taxes. But it kind of gave me this moment to stop and say, maybe we've done some things right in New Haven. New Haven might be kind of, given all the challenges facing cities and states right now, given the limits under which we operate in terms of how we can raise money in the city, given our state reliance on the property tax system and state enabling legislation required to have new revenues, I kind of thought it wasn't such a bad news week. I mean, any thoughts on that? Well, Bounce was talking this morning with someone from Connecticut Conference of Municipalities of this actual crisis at the legislature. It has brought back on the table ideas that were going to be killed this year, like having tolls that are interstate highways
legalizing
marijuana to bring in some revenue.
Well, the toll spot. I don't get it why people have a problem with that.
Yeah, because you go other places with nothing but tolls.
That's the idea. All our other states, when you go in and out, you drive out on the highway, you have to pay the toll.
And that other people that are not from your community are driving on your roads, and you have to pay for that.
I just think that we just let too many people come from New York into Massachusetts, tearing up our roads, and then, you know, don't think it's only on the highway they go. No, they do Route 1. They do, you know, in the city traffic as well. So we should have tolls back up on the highway too.
The thing is about marijuana. So Daniel Malloy in the past, the governor, has been against legalizing marijuana. He still doesn't like it, but he says recreational use. But he said, look, they just did it in Massachusetts. Our surrounding states are doing it. We might as well do it and get the revenue probably. He's not going to oppose that.
But it's not going to happen.
Well, here, what I'm thinking about is U.S.
It's Jeff Sessions.
Is Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So all these states have legalized marijuana or loosen rules about at least medical marijuana. The Obama administration allowed that to happen by looking the other way at federal law that would contradict it. Jeff Sessions has been very clear, and he's followed through on other things he's cleared, and he just hasn't gotten this yet because this isn't as important as his hatred of racial minorities and immigrants, so he's taking care of that first with his policies.
And his stock in four prisons.
He has made it, but he's made it clear that he does not approve of marijuana legalization, and the federal government has tools to block it. I'm wondering if Connecticut's in danger if they legalize marijuana to then running into a chainsaw from the U.S.
Is there no states' right argument?
Well, they give up all
the... I'm like, borrow from the South. He likes the South.
Confederate Klansmen like Jeff Sessions put state rights as their argument whenever it becomes civil rights legislation.
Right.
But,
exactly.
But the second they have power, they enforce their own social ideas
and prejudices. I need some unprecedented impeachment.
States, right.
Like group impeachment.
Group impeachment.
I need group impeachment.
I think the states' rights argument
is wrong now.
It's a bad argument on each side until you start passing the laws that say the states have the rights. You know, we all get lost in party issues, but there is no state rights.
I don't get lost in party issues.
You don't?
No.
I think what Harry's saying is that we all on the left embraced federal legislation to overturn states' rights to enforce civil rights legislation because we felt that the Constitution protected it, which is true. But the real reason is we just thought it was right. And what states were doing down there was wrong. We had to protect individual rights. So now states, you know, fought back against it, saying that when they founded the United States and with the U.S. Constitution, they in fact invested the states with a lot of rights. But now that the conservatives got power, they want to limit us, whether it comes to gay rights, transgender rights, or civil rights.
Any rights.
They want to stop, like Jeff Sessions, want to stop states from having local police departments have consent decrees about how not to brutalize black people. All of a sudden, he's against those states' rights. You know, so I think Harry's right. They're hypocritical on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
More so on the right than the left. Very much so more on the
Speaking of which, you know, about police accountability, there was a proposal on the table that two New Haven state legislators had, Robin Porter and Gary Winfield, to have a police accountability bill. That any time a police officer is accused of excessive force, the state police would have to come in, promptly do an investigation within 15 days, give you a sense of not necessarily there was a crime, but whether the officer seemed to be wrong and violating administrative procedures, and then put him on unpaid leave. That was getting nowhere until a police officer shot dead a young man in Bridgeport last week. Now it's actually back in the table. It's been revived and it might pass. And this week we had John Vileka, who's a retired police chief, who actually thinks that bill in some form should pass. It looks like it's back on the table. Any thoughts on that?
Well, accountability is always, I'm always for accountability. If you're going to have, but the state police is going to come in and investigate it,
Well, that's what they're doing now.
Yeah.
We always bring in the state police. We're pretty brutal force given what they did in New Haven.
Right.
That was going to be my worry. Because didn't they basically exonerate their own guys?
Unbelievable. And even the police dog or they attacked said, police officers.
Yeah, they're right. But everything was fine. All the procedures were followed.
Do you think that Gary and Robin are wrong to ask the state police to do it? Instead, there should be some other kind of outside agency,
independent agency of sort.
That's always my worry, though. Who would be the outside agency to do it?
Well, it's funny. John Fleck brought that up when we talked about the civilian review board here. He believes that there are qualified people, whether they've been private investigators, whether they've been attorneys, whether they've been that risk managers.
How would these people be selected?
Maybe you'd have some kind of nonpartisan board that invests these people with the authority to do that.
We can't create a board, and even if they're elected.
I'm not against it. I'm curious about the procedure.
Yeah, I am too. Yeah. It's kind of complicated.
It is complicated. And I think that's, why you might go to a state police and say, y'all have been doing this, make this a part of your responsibilities.
But complication, maybe, you see, that's why we have this problem, because nobody wants to go through the complicated section of the process.
Maybe want some immediacy, because that process is probably going to take longer.
Norma,
I come from the school of thought that there should be, the police officers should be trained to be able to stop someone without having to kill them.
Well,
you're talking about a 15-year-old kid.
That's a good school of thought.
No, they are trained to do that, just not in our communities.
I think Norma's right on the button. A lot of what John Vlecka talked about is they're trained to continue these chases. He said a lot of cops often wait for the supervisors to tell them, stop this chase. Now, what happened in Bridgeport, it's often with people who are the victims were actually up to no good, but the question is, because the same officer in Bridgeport who shot this guy dead, now it turns out there's a federal suit where he had another chase over less than half of an ounce of marijuana where he hurt somebody. And the question that Vlecka was making is it puts the cops in greater danger to do all these chases like the Malik Jones case, where why were they doing this high-speed chase across town, boxing in a car in a lot, running out, nothing, a go-to-hell look. When he shot him, he broke the window and said, now I thought he was dangerous because he gave me a go-to-hell look and I shot him dead. And that was considered okay because they considered the police department officer, once he got in that position, had a reasonable thought that his life might be in danger. In
what all these cases, go to hell look.
Yeah, man, that's ridiculous. But anyway, I think Norma's right on point. Is that a lot of this is training.
that one right there.
That's not a go to hell look.
You look at me all the time with your go to hell look.
But that's not a go to hell look. I think you're misreading this.
That was a what the hell look.
Make sure he don't have a gun in the back.
I'm not.
I don't know. All we gotta do is let that finger spinner.
I like the bill. It's just a time limit of 15 days.
Here's what kind of look this is. What kind of a look is a go to hell look? That's what look.
So
that
a what
is.
The hell look?
As long as Harry's not armed.
You got to be able to distinguish.
Yeah. Well, but I think it's about training. When we have these big arguments about these incidents, because often the victims of police misconduct weren't choir boys, that changes the subject. Or because once the police put themselves in a bad situation, there was a reason for them to be nervous for their safety. Or because often it's true that you can't bring a criminal charge, we lose the ability to discuss what are the roots of that encounter. How could a police officers and the people they shot have been safer to begin with if they were trained differently? And 20 years after Malik Jones, we still have not gotten to the point, in my opinion, where we can look at how we're chasing without the discussion running off the rails, without talking about how to train police officers to defuse, despite the rhetoric we're hearing in New Haven now.
I don't even know if it's train or defuse, because I think they're trained. I think people have inherent biases against black skin.
When they see
black skin and brown skin, they just automatically feel superior. And let me show them who is
so in
charge.
So in dealing with that, dealing with the root issues of bias, can't we also train people not as law enforcement?
No.
Not to jump to conclusions and make a situation more dangerous?
No, because this is something that they've been riding with for years. This is something they picked up and been rolling with that mentality.
When Paul says jump to conclusion, right? Mm-hmm. So the guy stole the car.
Yeah.
What's the conclusion?
He still don't lose right to live.
No. Then he...
You telling me
he
that people,
starts a chase?
So you telling me people in the suburbs don't steal? Don't
but
steal cars?
He didn't start a chase. He didn't start a chase.
Wait a minute! He
doesn't pull over.
But you telling me people
he's
in the suburbs
the
all pull over? What? You telling me people who live in the suburbs they all pull over when they steal cars?
When they steal cars?
Oh, they don't steal cars in the suburbs?
Yeah, if they steal cars, then they have to pull over. Well, how come we don't
hear about these kind of
shooting? You think they just let them go?
But how come we don't hear about these shootings?
See, most of them say that you can signal down the road with the license plate number. Hey, looks like this is where we should start the show. Sorry about the energy level about sexual abuse today, but
it's an important topic. It's a very important topic.
This wasn't our usual happy, giddy...
No, this is... And that's the good thing about this program. That's what I like coming over here. It's not always the same. You know, we're not going to always be...
Listen, we can't all sing and dance all the time.
Yeah, somebody got to sit down.
And you're lucky. You're lucky that I never sing and dance on the air.
And you realize Paul didn't even have to do one of his... And that's because you're listening to...
That's because I did it. I was like...
But you were you have been listening to Pundit Pride on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks to the best pundits in the media universe, Babs Rolls Ivy. Start early next week with Joe Ugly and Babs Rolls Ivy, 6 to 10 a.m. every day. Marquisha Ricks, Joe Ugly, Norma Rodriguez-Reyes, Harry Joe's the bravest man in New Haven. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. Now, we all know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book it and fly free with us all weekend long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.